consulting a therapist who understands teen issues. The stakes are simply too high to ignore professional help. Types of discipline. Many parents are confused by how to teach children to respect boundaries. They read countless books and articles on spanking, timeouts, restrictions, and allowances. While this question is beyond the scope of this book, a few thoughts may help organize the searching parent. 1. Consequences are intended to increase the child's sense of responsibility and control over his life. Discipline that increases the child's sense of helplessness isn't helpful. Dragging a 16-year-old girl to class doesn't build the internal motivation she'll need in 2 years when she's in college. A system of rewards and consequences that help her choose school for her own benefit has much better possibilities for success. 2. Consequences must be age-appropriate. You need to think through the meaning of your discipline. Spanking, for example, humiliates and angers a teenager. However, administered correctly, it can help build structure for a 4-year-old. 3. Consequences must be related to the seriousness of the infraction. Just as the penal system has different prison stays for different crimes, you must be able to distinguish between minor and severe infractions. Otherwise, severe penalties become meaningless. A client once told me, "I got whippings for little things and for big things, so I started getting more involved in big things. It just seemed more efficient." Once you've been sentenced to death, you don't have much to gain by being good. 4. The goal of boundaries is an internal sense of motivation with self-induced consequences. Successful parenting means that our kids want to get out of bed and go to school, be responsible, be empathic, and be caring because that's important to them, not because it's important to us. It's only when love and limits are a genuine part of the child's character that true maturity can occur. Otherwise, we are raising compliant parrots who will, in time, self-destruct. Parents have a sober responsibility. Teaching their children to have an internal sense of boundaries and to respect the boundaries of others. It's sober because the Bible says it's sober. Not many of you should presume to be teachers, my brothers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. James 3:1. There are certainly no guarantees that our training will be heeded. Children have the responsibility to listen and learn. The older they are, the more responsibility they have. Yet as we learn about our own boundary issues, take responsibility for them, and grow up ourselves, we increase our kids' chances to learn boundaries in an adult world in which these abilities will be sorely needed every day of their lives. Chapter 11, Boundaries and Work. In Sunday school, we were studying Adam and Eve and the fall. I learned that the fall was the beginning of everything bad. That day I went home and said to my mother, "I don't like Adam and Eve. If it weren't for them, I wouldn't have to clean up my room." Work at age 8 wasn't fun. And because it wasn't fun, it was bad. Because it was bad, it was Adam's fault. A simple theological theory for a youngster, but it was youthful heresy. Work existed before the fall. It was always part of God's plan for humanity. He planned for people to do two things. They would subdue, and they would rule. Genesis 1:28. They would bring the earth under their domain, and they would manage it. That sounds a lot like work. But because Eden was paradise, our difficulties with work came later, after the fall. God said to Adam, "Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return." Genesis 3, 17-19. Other aspects of the fall also affected our work. The first is the tendency toward disownership. We talked in earlier chapters about the boundary problem of not taking responsibility for what is ours. This started in the garden when Adam and Eve tried to pass the blame on to another for their original act of sinning. Adam blamed Eve. Eve blamed the serpent, Genesis 3:11-13. They were disowning their responsibility and blaming another. Their theme was, "Get the attention off of me." This tendency to blame another is a key work problem. The fall also divided love from work. Before the fall, Adam was connected to the love of God, and from that loved state he worked. After the fall, he was not motivated out of perfect love, but he had to work as a part of the fallen world's curse and the law. The love-motivated want to became a law-motivated should. Paul tells us the law's should increases our wish to rebel, Romans 5:20. It makes us angry at what we should do, Romans 4:15, and it arouses our motivations to do the wrong thing, Romans 7:5. All of this adds up to the human race being unable to take responsibility and work effectively by owning its behaviors, talents, and choices. No wonder we have work problems. In this chapter, we want to look at how boundaries can help resolve many work-related problems, as well as how they can help you to be happier and more fulfilled at the work you do. Work and character development. Christians often have a warped way of looking at work. Unless someone is working in the ministry, they see his work as secular. However, this view of work distorts the biblical picture. All of us, not only full-time ministers, have gifts and talents that we contribute to humanity. We all have a vocation, a calling into service. Wherever we work, whatever we do, we are to do unto the Lord. Colossians 3:23. Jesus used parables about work to teach us how to grow spiritually. These parables deal with money, with completing tasks, with faithful stewardship of a job, and with honest emotional dealings in work. They all teach character development in the context of relating to God and others. They teach a work ethic based on love under God. Work is a spiritual activity. In our work, we are made in the image of God, who is himself a worker, a manager, a creator, a developer, a steward, and a healer. To be a Christian is to be a co-laborer with God in the community of humanity. By giving to others, we find true fulfillment. The New Testament teaches that jobs offer more than temporal fulfillment and rewards on earth. Work is the place to develop our character in preparation for the work that we will do forever. With that in mind, let's look at how setting boundaries in the workplace can help us to grow spiritually. Problems in the workplace. A lack of boundaries creates problems in the workplace. In consulting for corporations, I have seen lack of boundaries as the major problem in many management squabbles. If people took responsibility for their own work and set clear limits, most of the problems for which I get consulted would not exist. Let's see how applying boundaries can solve some common problems in the workplace. Problem number one, getting saddled with another person's responsibilities. Susie is an administrative assistant in a small company that plans training sessions for industry. She's responsible for booking the training sessions and managing the speakers' schedules. A co-worker, Jack, is responsible for the training facilities. He takes the materials to the site, sets up the equipment, and orders the food. Together, Susie and Jack make the events happen. After a few months of really liking her work, Susie began to lose energy. Eventually, her friend and co-worker, Linda, asked her what was wrong. Susie couldn't put her finger on the problem at first. Then she realized the problem was Jack. Jack had been asking Susie to pick this up for me while you're out, or please bring this box of materials to the workshop. Slowly, Jack was shifting his responsibilities onto Susie.
"You have to stop doing Jack's work," Linda told Susie. "Just do your own work, and don't worry about him." "But what if things go wrong?" Susie asked.
Linda shrugged.
"Then they'll blame Jack. It's not your responsibility."
"Jack will be angry with me for not helping," Susie said.
"Let him," said Linda.
"His anger can't hurt you as much as his poor work habits can."
So Susie began to set limits on Jack. She told him,
"I will not have time to bring the materials for you this week." And when Jack ran out of time to do things himself, Susie said, "I'm sorry that you have not done that before now, and I understand that you're in a bind. Maybe next time you will plan better. That's not my job."
Some trainers were angry that their equipment was not set up, and customers were angry that no food was provided for the break. But the boss tracked down the problem to the person who was responsible, Jack, and told him to shape up or find another job. In the end, Susie began to like work again, and Jack began to get more responsible, all because Susie set boundaries and stuck to them. If you're being saddled with another person's responsibilities and feel resentful, you need to take responsibility for your feelings and realize that your unhappiness is not your co-worker's fault, but your own. In this, as in any other boundary conflict, you first must take responsibility for yourself. Then you must act responsibly to your co-worker. Go to your co-worker and explain your situation. When he asks you to do something that is not your responsibility, say no and refuse to do whatever it is that he wants you to do. If he gets angry at you for saying no, be firm about your boundaries and empathize with his anger. Don't get angry back. To fight anger with anger is to get hooked into his game. Keep your emotional distance and say, "I'm sorry if this upsets you, but that job is not my responsibility. I hope you get it worked out." If he continues to argue, tell him that you are finished discussing it. He can come and find you when he's ready to talk about something else. Do not fall into the trap of justifying why you can't do his work for him. You will be slipping into his thinking that you should do his work if you are able to, and he will try to find a way that you can. You owe no one an explanation about why you will not do something that is not your responsibility. Many over-responsible people who work next to under-responsible people bear the consequences for their co-workers. Always covering for them or bailing them out, they are not enjoying their work or their relationships with these people. Their lack of boundaries is hurting them, as well as keeping the other person from growing. If you are one of these people, you need to learn to set boundaries. Sometimes, however, a co-worker will genuinely need some extra help. It is perfectly legitimate to bail out a responsible co-worker or to make special concessions to a colleague who uses those concessions responsibly to get well. This is love, and good companies operate lovingly. In our work as psychologists at the same hospital, we often cover hospital duty for each other or take each other's on-call time. But if one of us started taking advantage of the other, we would need to stop that. Covering for the other at that point would not be helpful, but would enable a bad pattern. Favors and sacrifices are part of the Christian life. Enabling is not. Learn to tell the difference by seeing if your giving is helping the other to become better or worse. The Bible requires responsible action out of the one who is given to. If you do not see it after a season, set limits. Luke 13:9. Problem number two, working too much overtime. When I first went into practice, I hired a woman for 20 hours a week to run my office. On her second day in the office, I gave her a pile of things to do. About 10 minutes later, she knocked at my door, stack of papers in hand. "What can I do for you, Laurie?" I asked.
"You have a problem," she told me.
"I do? What is it?" I asked, not having the vaguest idea what she was talking about.
"You hired me for 20 hours a week, and you've just given me about 40 hours of work. Which 20 would you like done?"
She was right. I did have a problem.
I had not managed my workload very well. I was either going to have to spend more on help, cut back on projects, or hire someone else. But she was right. It was my problem, not hers. I had to take responsibility for it and fix it. Lori was telling me what that ever-present sign says. Poor planning on your part does not constitute an emergency on my part. Many bosses aren't so lucky. Their employees take responsibility for their lack of planning and never set limits on them. They are never forced to look at their lack of boundaries until it's too late, until they have lost a good employee to exhaustion or burnout. Such bosses need clear limits, but many employees are afraid to set them, as Lori did, because they need the job or they fear disapproval. If you are in a situation in which you're doing lots of extra work because you need the job and because you are afraid of being let go, you have a problem. If you are working more overtime than you want to, you are in bondage to your job. You are a slave, not an employee under contract. Clear and responsible contracts tell all parties involved what is expected of them, and they can be enforced. Jobs should have clear descriptions of duties and qualifications. As hard as it sounds, you need to take responsibility for yourself and take steps to change your situation. Here are some suggested steps you may wish to take. 1. Set boundaries on your work. Decide how much overtime you are willing to do. Some overtime during seasonal crunches may be expected of you. 2. Review your job description, if one exists. 3. Make a list of the tasks you need to complete in the next month. Make a copy of the list and assign your own priority to each item. Indicate on this copy any tasks that are not part of your job description. 4. Make an appointment to see your boss to discuss your job overload. Together, you should review the list of tasks you need to complete in the next month. Have your boss prioritize the tasks. If your boss wants all the tasks done, and you cannot complete these tasks in the time you are willing to give, your boss may need to hire temporary help to complete these tasks. You may also wish to review your job description with your boss at this time if you think you are doing things that fall outside your domain. If your boss still has unreasonable expectations of you, you may wish to take a co-worker or two along with you to a second meeting, according to the biblical model in Matthew 18, or you may wish to discuss your problem with the appropriate person in your personnel department. If even then he remains unreasonable about what he thinks you can accomplish, you may need to begin looking for other job opportunities within your company or outside. You may need to go to night school and get some further training to open up other opportunities. You may need to chase down hundreds of employment ads and send out stacks of resumes. Consult the book How to Get a Job by James Bramlett for information on job searches. You may wish to start your own business. You may wish to start an emergency fund to survive between quitting your present job and starting a new one. Whatever you do, remember that your job overload is your responsibility and your problem. If your job is driving you crazy, you need to do something about it. Own the problem. Stop being a victim of an abusive situation and start setting some limits. Problem number 3. Misplaced priorities. We have talked about setting limits on someone else. You also need to set limits on yourself. You need to realize how much time and energy you have and manage your work accordingly. Know what you can do and when you can do it, and say no to everything else. Learn to know your limits and enforce them, as Lori did. Say to your team or your boss, "If I'm going to do A today, I will not be able to do B until Wednesday. Is that okay? Or do we need to rethink which one I need to be working on?" Effective workers do two things. They strive to do excellent work, and they spend their time on the most important things. Many people do excellent work, but allow themselves to get sidetracked by unimportant things. They may do unimportant things very well. They feel like they are doing a great job, but their boss is upset because essential goals are not being met. Then they feel underappreciated and resentful because they have put out so much effort. They were working hard, but they weren't placing boundaries on what they allowed to take up their time, and the really important things did not get their attention. Say no to the unimportant, and say no to the inclination to do less than your best. If you are doing your best work on the most important things, you will reach your goals. In addition to saying no to the unimportant, you need to make a plan to accomplish the important things and erect some fences around your tasks. Realize your limits and make sure you do not allow work to control your life. Having limits will force you to prioritize. If you make a commitment to spend only so many hours a week on work, you will spend those hours more wisely. If you think your time is limitless, you may say yes to everything. Say yes to the best, and sometimes you may need to say no to the good. One man's ministry required a lot of travel, so he and his wife put their heads together and decided that he would spend no more than 100 nights a year on the road. When he gets an offer, he has to check his time budget and see if this is something he wants to spend some of his nights on. This plan forces him to be more selective in his travel, thereby saving time for the rest of his life. A company president who was allowing work to keep him away from home too much made a commitment to spend only 40 hours a week in the office. At first, he really struggled because he wasn't used to budgeting his time and commitments so closely. Slowly, though, when he realized that he only had so much time, he began to spend it more wisely. He even got more accomplished because he was forced to work smarter. Work will grow to fill the time you have set aside for it. If a meeting does not have an agenda with time limits, discussion could be endless. Allot time for certain things, and then keep your limits. You will work smarter and like your work more. Take a lesson from Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, who, seeing Moses' lack of boundaries, asked him why he was working so hard. Exodus 18:14-27. "Because the people need me," Moses said. "What you are doing is not good," Jethro replied. "You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone." Verses 17 and 18. Even though Moses was doing good work, Jethro saw that he was going to burn himself out. Moses had allowed good work to go too far. Limits on good things keep them good. Problem number 4. Difficult co-workers. A personnel counselor will often send someone to our hospital program because of stress at work. When these situations are unraveled, the stress at work often turns out to be someone at the office who is driving the stressed-out person crazy. This person in the office or workplace has a strong influence over the emotional life of the person in pain, and he or she does not know how to deal with it. In this case, you need to remember the law of power. You only have the power to change yourself. You can't change another person. You must see yourself as the problem, not the other person. To see another person as the problem to be fixed is to give that person power over you and your well-being. Because you cannot change another person, you are out of control. The real problem lies in how you are relating to the problem person. You are the one in pain, and only you have the power to fix it. Many people have found immense relief in the thought that they have no control over another person, and that they must focus on changing their reactions to that person. They must refuse to allow that person to affect them. This idea is life-changing, the beginning of true self-control. Problem number 5. Critical attitudes. Stress is often caused by working with or for someone who is super critical. People will get hooked into either trying to win over the critical person, which can almost never be done, or by allowing the person to provoke them to anger. Some people internalize the criticism and get down on themselves. All of these reactions indicate an inability to stand apart from the critical person and keep one's boundaries. Allow these critical people to be who they are, but keep yourself separate from them, and do not internalize their opinion of you. Make sure you have a more accurate appraisal of yourself, and then disagree internally. You may also want to confront the overly critical person according to the biblical model, Matthew 18. At first, tell her how you feel about her attitude and the way it affects you. If she is wise, she will listen to you. If not, and her attitude is disruptive to others as well, two or more of you might want to talk to her. If she will not agree to change, you may want to tell her that you do not wish to talk with her until she gets her attitude under control. Or you can follow the company's grievance policy. The important thing to remember is that you can't control her, but you can choose to limit your exposure to her, either physically or emotionally distancing yourself from her. This is self-control. Avoid trying to gain the approval of this sort of person. It will never work, and you will only feel controlled. And avoid getting in arguments and discussions. You will never win. Remember the proverb, "Whoever corrects a mocker invites insult. Whoever rebukes a wicked man incurs abuse. Do not rebuke a mocker, or he will hate you. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love you." Proverbs 9:7-8. If you allow them to draw you in, thinking that you will change them, you are asking them for trouble. Stay separate. Keep your boundaries. Don't get sucked into the game. Problem number 6. Conflict with authority. If you are having trouble getting along with your boss, you may be having transference feelings. Transference is when you experience feelings in the present that really belong to some unfinished business in the past. Transference happens frequently with bosses because they are authority figures. The boss-employee relationship can trigger authority conflicts you might have. You can begin to have strong reactions that are not appropriate to the current relationship. Suppose your supervisor tells you that he wants something done differently. Immediately, you feel put down. You think, "He never thinks I do anything right. I'll show him." Your supervisor may have made the comment in passing, but the feelings it triggered were very strong indeed. The reality is that the interaction may be tapping into unresolved hurt from past authority relationships, such as parents or teachers. When a transference relationship starts, you may begin to act out all the old patterns you did with parents. This never works. You become a child on the job. To have boundaries is to take responsibility for your transference. If you find yourself having strong reactions to someone, take some time and look inside to see if the feelings are familiar. Do they remind you of someone from the past? Did Mom or Dad treat you like that? Do they have the same personality as this person? You are responsible for working out these feelings. Until you face your own feelings, you can't even see who others really are. You are looking at them through your own distortions, through your own unfinished business. When you see others clearly, without transference, you will know how to deal with them. Another example would be strong feelings of competition with a coworker. This may represent some competitive relationship from the past, such as sibling rivalry that has not been worked through. Whenever you experience strong feelings, see them as part of your responsibility. This will lead you to any unfinished business and healing, as well as keep you from acting irrationally toward coworkers and bosses. Leave the past in the past. Deal with it, and do not allow it to interfere with present relationships. Problem number 7. Expecting too much of work. People increasingly come to the workplace wanting the company to be a family. In a society where the family, church, and community are not the support structures they once were, people look to their colleagues for the emotional support a family once provided. This lack of boundaries between the personal and work life is fraught with all sorts of difficulties. The workplace ideally should be supportive, safe and nurturing, but this atmosphere should primarily support the employee in work-related ways, to help her learn, improve, and get a job done. The problem arises when someone wants the job to provide what her parents did not provide for her. Primary nurturing, relationship, self-esteem, and approval. Work is not set up this way, nor is it what the typical job asks of someone. The inherent conflict in this setup is this. The job expects adult functioning, and the person wants childhood needs met. These differing expectations will inevitably collide. Health comes from owning unmet childhood needs and working them out. The problem is that the workplace is not the place to do that. There are expectations at work. They will ask from you without giving because they are going to pay you for your work. They are not obligated to provide all the emotional support you need. You need to make sure you are meeting your needs for support and emotional repair outside of work. Plug into supportive and healing networks that will help you to grow out of your emotional hurts and unmet needs and build you up so you can function well at the job in the adult world that has adult expectations. Get your relationship needs met outside of work, and then you will be able to work the best without getting your needs mixed up with what the company needs from you. Keep your boundaries firm. Protect those hurt places from the workplace, which is not only not set up to heal, but also may wound unintentionally. Problem number 8. Taking work-related stress home. Just as we should keep good boundaries on our personal issues and keep them out of the workplace, we need to keep some boundaries on work and keep it out of the home. This generally has two components. The first is emotional. Conflicts at work need to be dealt with and worked through so they do not begin to affect the rest of your life. If denied, they can cause major depressions and other illnesses that begin to spill over into other areas of life. Make sure you understand work issues and face them directly so that work does not emotionally control your life. Find out why a certain coworker is able to get to you, or why your boss is able to control the rest of your life. Find out why your successes or failures on the job are able to bring you up or down. These important character issues need to be worked through. Otherwise, the job will own you. The second component is finite things such as time, energy, and other resources. Make sure that the job, which is literally never done, does not continue to spill over into personal life and cost you relationships and other things that matter. Put limits on special projects that are going to take more time than usual, and make sure overtime does not become a pattern. One company we know has such a high value for family that they dock people for working overtime. They want them to put limits on their work and be home with the family. Find out your own limits and live by them. These are good boundaries. Problem number 9. Disliking your job. Boundaries are where our identity comes from. Boundaries define what is me and what is not me. Our work is part of our identity in that it taps into our particular giftedness and the exercise of those gifts in the community. However, many people are unable to ever find a true work identity. They stumble from job to job, never really finding anything that is them. More often than not, this is a boundary problem. They have not been able to own their own gifts, talents, wants, desires, and dreams because they are unable to set boundaries on others' definitions and expectations of them. This happens with people who have not separated from the family they grew up in. A pastor was having great difficulty with his church and the board of elders. Finally, right in the middle of a consistory meeting, he said, "I never wanted to be a pastor anyway. It was my mother's wish, not mine." He did not have good enough boundaries with his mother to define his own career path. As a result, he had fused with her wishes and was miserable. His heart had not been in it from the start. This can happen also with friends and culture. Others' expectations can be very strong influences. You must make sure that your boundaries are strong enough that you do not let others define you. Instead, work with God to find out who you really are and what kind of work you are made for. Romans 12:2 speaks of having boundaries against these kinds of pressures from others. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. You should have a realistic expectation of yourself based on who you really are, your own true self with your own particular giftedness. You can only do this with boundaries that stand up and say, "This is me, and this is not me." Stand up against others' expectations of you. Finding your life's work. Finding your life's work involves taking risks. First, you need to firmly establish your identity, separating yourself from those you are attached to, and following your desires. You must take ownership of how you feel, how you think, and what you want. You must assess your talents and limitations, and then you must begin to step out as God leads you. For God wants you to discover and use your gifts to His glory. He asks only that you include Him in the process. Delight yourself in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in Him, and He will do this. Psalms 37:4-5. God also, however, calls you to be accountable for what you do. Follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see, but know that for all these things God will bring you to judgment. Ecclesiastes 11:9. As you develop your talents, look at your work as a partnership between you and God. He has given you gifts, and He wants you to develop them. Commit your way to the Lord, and you will find your work identity. Ask Him to help. Chapter 12, Boundaries and Yourself. Sarah heaved a long sigh. She had been working on major boundary issues in her therapy for a while now. She was seeing progress in resolving responsibility conflicts with her parents, her husband, and her kids. Yet today, she introduced a new issue.
"I haven't told you about this relationship before, though I guess I should have. I have tremendous boundary problems with this woman. She eats too much and has an attacking tongue. She's undependable, lets me down all the time, and she's spent money of mine and hasn't paid me back in years."
"Why haven't you mentioned her before?" I asked.
"Because she's me," Sarah replied.
Sarah was echoing the conflict most of us have. We learn that boundaries are biblical. We begin setting limits on others. We begin moving from taking too much responsibility to taking just enough. But how do we begin to set limits on ourselves? As Pogo Possum, cartoonist Walt Kelly's popular swamp character, says,
"We have met the enemy, and he is us."
In this chapter, instead of looking at the control and manipulation of others, we'll be looking at our responsibility to control our own bodies. 1 Thessalonians 4:4. Instead of examining outer boundary conflicts with other people, we will be looking at our own internal boundary conflicts. This can get a little touchy. As the disgruntled country church member told his pastor as he left after the Sunday sermon, "You done stopped preaching and you done started meddling." Instead of this defensive posture, we are much better off to look humbly at ourselves, to ask for feedback from others, to listen to people we trust, and to confess, "I was wrong." Our out-of-control soul. Eating. Teresa's secret shame was becoming more difficult to keep a secret. Her 5'4" frame could hide a little extra weight, but over the past few months she had gradually moved into the mid-hundred mark. She hated it. Her dating life, her stamina, and her attitude toward herself were all affected. She was out of control. In her successful but stressful career as an attorney, cookies and candy were the only place she could go when everything was falling down around her. 12-hour days meant lots of isolation, and absolutely nothing filled the void like fatty foods. No wonder they call it comfort food, Teresa would think. What makes overeating especially painful is that overweight is visible to others. The overweight person feels enormous self-hate and shame about her condition. And, like others who suffer from out-of-control behaviors, the overweight person feels overwhelming shame for her behavior, which drives her away from relationship and back to food. Both chronic and binging overeaters suffer from an internal self-boundary problem. For overeaters, food serves as a false boundary. They might use food to avoid intimacy by gaining weight and becoming less attractive. Or they might binge as a way to get false closeness. For bingers, the comfort from food is less scary than the prospect of real relationships, where boundaries would be necessary. Money. A now famous bumper sticker reads, "I can't be overdrawn. I still have checks left." People have tremendous problems in many different areas dealing with money, including the following: impulse spending, careless budgeting, living beyond one's means, credit problems, chronically borrowing from friends, ineffectual savings plans, working more to pay all the bills, enabling others. God intended for money to be a blessing to us and others. Give, and it will be given to you. Luke 6:38. In fact, the Bible says that the problem isn't money, it's the love of money that is a root of all kinds of evil. 1 Timothy 6:10. Most of us would certainly agree that we need to be in control of our finances. Saving money, keeping costs down, and shopping for discounts are all good things. It's tempting to see money problems as simply a need for more income. However, the problem often isn't the high cost of living, it's the cost of high living. The problem of our financial outgo exceeding our input is a self-boundary issue. When we have difficulty saying no to spending more than we should, we run the risk of becoming someone else's servant. The rich rule over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. Proverbs 22:7. Time. Many people feel that their time is out of control. They are 11th-hour people, constantly on the edge of deadlines. Try as they might, they find the day, every day, getting away from them. There just aren't enough hours to accomplish their tasks. The word early doesn't seem to be part of their personal experience. Some of the time binds these strugglers deal with are these: business meetings, luncheon appointments, project deadlines, church and school activities, holiday mailings. These people breeze into meetings 15 minutes late and breathlessly apologize, talking about traffic, overwhelming job responsibilities, or kid emergencies. People whose time is out of control inconvenience others whether they mean to or not. The problem often stems from one or more of the following causes. 1. Omnipotence. These people have unrealistic, somewhat grandiose expectations of what they can accomplish in a given amount of time. "No problem. I'll do it," is their motto. 2. Over-responsibility for the feelings of others. They think that leaving a party too early will cause the host to feel abandoned. 3. Lack of realistic anxiety. They live so much in the present that they neglect to plan ahead for traffic, parking the car, or dressing for an outing. 4. Rationalization. They minimize the distress and inconvenience that others must put up with because of their lateness. They think, "They're my friends. They'll understand." The person with undeveloped time self-boundaries ends up frustrating not only others, but himself. He ends the day without the sense that a desire realized is sweet to the soul. Proverbs 13:19. Instead, he is left with unrealized desires, half-baked projects, and the realization that tomorrow will begin with him running behind schedule. Task completion. A first cousin to the time boundary problem, task completion deals with finishing well. Most of us have goals in the love and work areas of life. We may wish to be a veterinarian or a lawyer. We may wish to own our own business or own a home in the country. We may wish to start a Bible study program or an exercise regimen. We all would like to say about our tasks, whether large or small, what Paul said, "I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith. Now there is in store for me the crown of righteousness." 2 Timothy 4:7-8. More eloquent in their simplicity are Jesus' words on the cross, "It is finished." John 19:30. Though they may be great starters, many Christians find themselves unable to be good finishers. For one reason or another, creative ideas don't pan out. A regular schedule of operations becomes bogged down. Success looms, then is suddenly snatched away. The problem with many poor finishers lies in one of the following causes. 1. Resistance to structure. Poor finishers feel that submitting to the discipline of a plan is a put-down. 2. Fear of success. Poor finishers are over-concerned that success will cause others to envy and criticize them. Better to shoot themselves in the foot than to lose their buddies. 3. Lack of follow-through. Poor finishers have an aversion to the boring nuts and bolts of turning the crank on a project. They are much more excited about birthing the idea than turning it over to other people to execute it. 4. Distractibility. Poor finishers are unable to focus on a project until it's done. They have often never developed competent concentration skills. 5. Inability to delay gratification. Poor finishers are unable to work through the pain of a project to experience the satisfaction of a job well done. They want to go directly to the pleasure. They are like children who want to eat dessert before they eat the well-balanced meal. 6. Inability to say no to other pressures. Poor finishers are unable to say no to other people and projects. They don't have time to finish any job well. Those with task completion problems often feel like 2-year-olds in their favorite toy area. They'll bang a hammer for a bit, vroom with a toy car, talk to a puppet, and then pick up a book, all in 2 minutes or less. It's easy to see the boundary problems inherent in those with task completion problems. Their internal no hasn't been developed enough to keep them focused on finishing things. The tongue. In a therapy group I was leading, a man held the floor for some time. He'd go off on tangents, change the subject, and spend inordinate amounts of time on irrelevant details. He couldn't seem to get to the point. Other members were spacing out, dozing off, or becoming restless. Just as I was about to speak to the man's struggle with getting to the point, a woman in the group spoke up, saying bluntly, "Bill, talk net, will ya?" Talking net, putting a net or boundary on their words, can be a struggle for many. How we use language can deeply affect the quality of our relationships. The tongue can be a source of both blessing and curse. James 3:9-10. It can be a blessing when we use our tongue to empathize, identify, encourage, confront, and exhort others. It can be a curse when we use it to talk non-stop to hide from intimacy, dominate conversations to control others, gossip, make sarcastic remarks expressing indirect hostility, threaten someone expressing direct hostility, flatter instead of authentically praise, seduce. Many people who have difficulty setting verbal boundaries on themselves aren't really aware of their problem. They are often genuinely surprised when a friend says to them, "Sometimes it seems like you interpret my commas as periods." I knew a woman who was desperately afraid that others would get to know her. She asked questions and talked quickly so that no one could turn the conversation toward her. She had only one problem. She had to take breaths to continue talking, and the breath created a space for someone else to say something. The woman resolved her problem, however, in an ingenious way. She drew her breaths in the middle of her sentences rather than at the end. That kept people sufficiently off balance so that she was rarely interrupted. An effective strategy, with only one problem, she had to keep finding new people to talk to. After a few rounds with her, people disappeared. The scriptures tell us to treat our words carefully. When words are many, sin is not absent, but he who holds his tongue is wise. Proverbs 10:19. A man of knowledge uses words with restraint. Proverbs 17:27. According to the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for restrain refers to the free action of holding back something or someone. The actor has the power over the object. It's a boundary-laden term. We have the power to set boundaries on what comes out of our mouths. When we can't hold back or set boundaries on what comes from our lips, our words are in charge, not us. But we are still responsible for those words. Our words do not come from somewhere outside of us as if we were a ventriloquist's dummy. They are the product of our hearts. Our saying, "I didn't mean that," is probably better translated, "I didn't want you to know I thought that about you." We need to take responsibility for our words. But I tell you that men will have to give account on the day of judgment for every careless word they have spoken. Matthew 12:36. Sexuality. As Christians are finding more safe places in the church to be honest about spiritual and emotional conflicts, sexual problems, especially for men, have emerged as a major issue. Such problems include compulsive masturbation, compulsive heterosexual or homosexual relationships, pornography, prostitution, exhibitionism, voyeurism, obscene phone calls, indecent liberties, child molestation, incest, and rape. The individual caught up in an out-of-control sexual behavior generally feels deeply isolated and shameful. This keeps what is broken in the soul sequestered in the darkness, out of the light of relationship with God and others, where there can be neither help nor resolution. His sexuality takes on a life of its own, unreal and fantasy-driven. One man described it as a not-me experience. It was, for him, as if the real him was watching his sexual actions from across the room. Others may feel so dead and detached that sexuality is the only way they feel alive. The problem, however, is that, as in most internal boundary conflicts, sexual boundarylessness becomes a tyrant, demanding and insatiable. No matter how many orgasms are reached, the desire only deepens, and the inability to say no to one's lusts drives one deeper into despair and hopelessness. Alcohol and substance abuse. Probably the clearest examples of internal boundary problems, alcohol and drug dependencies create devastation in the lives of addicts. Divorce, job loss, financial havoc, medical problems, and death are the fruits of the inability to set limits in these areas. Most tragic are the increasingly younger children who are experimenting with drugs. Drug addiction is difficult for adults who have some semblance of character and boundaries. For the child, whose boundaries are delicate and forming, the results are often lifelong and debilitating. Why doesn't my no work? "I'm throwing my no away," Bert told me. It works fine for setting limits on other people, but every time I try to complete my tasks on time, it breaks down. Where can I trade it in? Where indeed? As you heard about the out-of-control areas we've just mentioned, you may have felt defeated and frustrated with yourself. You probably could identify with one or more of the problem areas, and you probably are no stranger to the discouragement of not having mature boundaries in these internal areas. What's the problem? Why doesn't our no work on ourselves? There are at least three reasons for this. One, we are our own worst enemies. An external problem is easier to deal with than an internal one. When we switch our focus from setting limits on other people to setting limits on ourselves, we make a major shift in responsibility. Previously, we were only responsible to, not for, the other party. Now we have a great deal more involvement. We are the other party. We are responsible for ourselves. When you are around a critical person, the kind who finds fault with everything, you can set limits on your exposure to this person's constant criticism. You can change subjects, rooms, houses, or continents. You can leave. But what if this critical person is in your own head? What if you are the person with the problem? What if you have met the enemy and he is you? Two, we withdraw from relationship when we most need it. Jessica came to me for treatment of an eating disorder. She was 30 years old, and she had been binging since she was a teenager. I asked her about her previous attempts to solve this internal boundary problem.
I try to work out and eat right, she said, but I always fall back.
Who do you talk to about this? I asked.
What do you mean?
Jessica looked confused. Who do you tell about your eating problem when you can't take it anymore? Tears welled up in Jessica's eyes.
You're asking too much. This is a private problem. Can't I do this without anyone knowing?
Since the fall, our instincts have been to withdraw from relationship when we're in trouble, when we most need other people. Remember how Adam and Eve hid from God after they ate the forbidden fruit? Due to our lack of security, our loss of grace, our shame and our pride, we turn inward rather than outward when we're in trouble. And that's a problem. As the preacher in Ecclesiastes put it, "Woe to one who is alone and falls and does not have another to help." 4:10. Such withdrawal happens in our hospital program time after time. Hurting people will begin to make attachments with staff or other patients. For the first time, they begin coming forth with their need for connection. Like a rose lifting its petals after a hard rain, they begin to relate and connect in the light of the grace of God and His people. Then an unexpected difficulty will occur. Sometimes their depression will temporarily worsen as their pain inside is exposed. Sometimes traumatic memories will surface. Sometimes severe conflict will occur with family members. Instead of bringing these painful and frightening feelings and problems to their newfound relationships, these people will often retreat to their rooms to work out the problem. They'll spend several hours or a day doing everything possible to get back under control. They'll talk positively to themselves or read scriptures compulsively to try to make themselves feel better. It is only when this attempt at a solution breaks down that they finally realize that these spiritual pains and burdens need to be brought out of themselves to the body of Christ. To the isolated person, nothing feels more frightening, unsafe, or unwise. Such a person needs to feel very secure before she will risk taking her spiritual and emotional problems to other people. And yet, the Bible doesn't recognize any other answer to our problems. Grace must come from the outside of ourselves to be useful and healing. Just as the branch withers without the vine, John 15:1-6. We can sustain neither life nor emotional repair without bonding to God and others. God and His people are